Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 10K Collective podcast. Very happy to be here with a brand new podcast, and this is aimed at you, the advanced Amazon seller, or at least somebody who's got some revenue and is basically a serious person wanting to scale up big. And today we've got a couple of guests who are going to help the really ambitious people who want to build an asset to sell, and that is two people from Wall Street, no less. So we're honored to have on Chris Shipfilling and Jason Somerville of Global Wired Advisors and Providium. So guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to see you both. I like the simultaneously. Hi, that's great. You guys are coordinated. Your vaudeville, we're like, there's a few.
We rehearsed it.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. It's all part of the theatre. So, guys, can you give us a bit of background about each of you personally first? Because it's always good to know who's the person giving the advice before we go any further.
Yeah, no problem. My background is I've traditionally been in a lot of different marketing roles. I've worked. I cut my teeth in sales to start. Worked on the manufacturing side. So worked for various different companies and also worked with new product developments, product marketing, trade marketing, and eventually slowly rolled into focusing on digital marketing and also specifically Amazon. I've been working with Amazon Vendor Central for almost 14 years, but recently, about 4 years ago, started diving in very deeply into Seller Central and really understanding the mechanics of what it means to be a seller, a brand selling through Seller Central. And so I've done some Amazon consulting over the past few years with some larger brands that helped go from Vendor Central to Seller Central, brands that didn't have any clue what they were doing with Seller Central. I met these guys at Providium over a year ago, and we just started chit-chatting about Amazon and about digitally native businesses, and here we are. Now we're helping people exit their business for maximum value.
Excellent. So exit business for maximum value. That's a very, very clear aim that you achieve for people. That's fantastic. So Jason, tell us a little bit more about you.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. I've been investment banking and capital markets my entire career, going on 20 years now. I actually started with Bank of America, worked for them for a number of years in their capital markets group, and then moved on to a hedge fund in Miami, where we did a large variety of things, as most hedge funds tend to do. Worked for those guys for doing lots of different types of trades, lots of mergers and acquisitions, lots of debt and equity capital markets transactions. And then actually moved on for a few years, became purely entrepreneurial myself, started and purchased a number of businesses, grew those and exited those over the course of about, I'd say, 5 years. And then a couple of years ago, I actually met two other gentlemen who are not on this podcast with us, but there are two other partners who also come from similar backgrounds to mine, different trading and investment banking roles in very large bulge bracket companies. And we sat down and felt like that the smaller business world was really missing high quality expertise and high quality help, if you will, when it comes to selling their companies. So we felt like we could fill a void in the market. We could give those, you know, many owner operator and family owned businesses some really, you know, high quality help, you know, allow them to achieve outcomes that were much better than what they had been able to achieve before. So, you know, we did that. We started about 2 years ago with Providium Group, and that's the company that Chris referred to before. And then recently, in the last year, we actually started Global Wired Advisors, which is really a subsidiary of Providium. That's when Chris Shipfilling came in And we really wanted to focus Global Wired Advisors on online businesses, primarily Amazon-based businesses. And I've been doing that now for several months, and I've really enjoyed it. You know, I've met a lot of great clients and helped a lot of great clients along the way.
Wow, that's quite a lot to take in. So thank you very much, guys, for your backgrounds. I mean, obviously, you both had the entrepreneurial bug, which is very important. So you've been out there yourself trying to create businesses. Obviously, Chris, you've also got the background of helping Amazon sellers. So you understand the platform very, very well, which I guess is important because you're aware of, you know, how the precariousness of life on Amazon, I guess, which is kind of part of the picture, isn't it? And then Jason, just a couple of things I wanted to just dig into straight away, because I think these are the more, obviously, you know, Seller Central and Vendor Central, these are words we're very familiar with as Amazon sellers. But just to dig a little bit more into the background of this stuff, because it's partly, I guess, one world understanding another, right? That's part of what this is all about. I guess you guys are the people who bring the two sides together, the people with the money and the people with the businesses. Tell me a bit more about some of these buzzwords you were throwing around: capital markets, mergers and acquisitions, debt and equity, capital markets. I mean, obviously, these are words that in a way sound very familiar, but I want to just dig, without spending too long, but just dig a little bit more into what that actually means, first of all. And I suspect it may be a relevant background for Amazon sellers as well.
Sure. You know, at a very basic level, really, when I say capital markets, it's going out and accessing really funding through other parties. And that can be done through debt instruments, you know, hence debt capital markets. That can be done through selling of equity in the company. That's equity capital markets. And then there are, if you're talking about transactions that involve the majority or the entire business, then you get into mergers and acquisitions, where if one company is buying another company entirely, it's an acquisition. And if the two companies are merging together, and there's some technical nuances that I won't bore you with at the moment, but that would be effectively, you know, kind of what a merger is. So those are kind of how those four are as far as a high level. But, you know, in terms of, you know, the basic gist is accessing funding from outside parties through various means, essentially.
Okay, great. So that makes an awful lot of sense. So in other words, basically, you give up something, part of your company, either you owe them a debt or equity, or the whole thing is moved in one go, and then they give you money for it. So I guess it's a kind of obvious thing. I just thought it's worth digging into, because people are always throwing these big words around, and if you dig deeper, people don't know what it means. They just wanted to look clever. And like, I live in London, so there's plenty of people wandering around talking about mergers and acquisitions and that sort of thing on the tube. But, you know, well, not on the tube. Nobody talks on the tube, but yeah. It's the same on the subway in New York as well. So guys, let's get into then. Thank you very much for the background. Very interesting already. Quite a different conversation than the standard thing of how do I get my products to rank this month. But tell me a bit, first of all, about the entire proposition of selling an Amazon business. Is it really the main option for most people long term? Why not just build an asset and just hang on to it for your whole lifetime and then pass it on to your grandchildren?
Yeah, I can answer some of that, and I'll let Jason take some of that as well. I mean, the short answer is yes, you can. You know, you can do whatever you want with your Amazon business. So, you know, if you want to build your Amazon business and you want to hold on to it as an asset that produces cash, that's obviously an option. Most people and most personalities that we come in contact with, and what we always give advice for with anyone who owns a business is, when you start a business, you should always be thinking about selling that business. Because typically when you sell the business, you can come out at the end making more than what you could potentially make, even with it being just a cash asset. There's a lot of nuances and headaches too that go along with owning your own business and growing your business. You know, you can grow a business and then you may have a very healthy business, but you hit a point where you need more capital. You need more money in the business to be able to grow the business further. So there's hurdles that can get in the way with that as well. So I would say a direct answer to your question is yes, you can hold on to it. But you know, I think with most entrepreneurs and personalities that we run into, they like solving the puzzle. And then when the puzzle's been solved for them, they want to go solve something else. And so we would love to give you a payout to go solve a harder puzzle, is how we like to put it. I don't know if Jason wants to add color to that.
Yeah, I like that thinking, first of all, just to reflect on that. And yeah, for sure, I'd love to have some input from you, Jason. So Yeah. I mean, one of the things I understand from the data says that the likelihood of your business being around for you to sell to your kids or pass on is kind of quite low, I guess, is one thing, isn't it? But also the question of making more money by selling it than you could running it, which is obviously important. Most entrepreneurs are pretty motivated by money. It would be strange if they weren't. But as you said, the other thing, the real key, and I like the fact you understand the entrepreneurial mindset. Yeah, we get bored or we're good at creating systems, but we're terrible at running them. I'm forever breaking Amazing FBA, for example, because I'll set up some system with my my little team and then I'll be the first one to break it. And they need to say, Mike, don't give us tasks on Skype, do it on Trello or whatever it is. So yeah, you're quite right. Entrepreneurs don't make great people for just keeping a steady ship. They like to be aggressively growing or doing something else. So very, very valid points indeed. So Jason, give us a bit of input on that thought. Is selling really the main option for people who own a business? I mean, why bother selling is another way of putting it.
Well, I'll just echo a couple things that Chris said. One is, if you own a business, we always advise to always think about the exit, because there's really no downside to be thinking about the exit. It's something that if you build your business in a way that it would be an attractive asset for someone to buy, even if you ended up not selling it, the things that you're going to do to make it attractive to an outside party are only going to be things that are going to benefit you as the owner ultimately. So that's one thing I would say. It's just a good mindset to have as a business owner, number one. Number two, again, a little bit of what Chris alluded to, it's very difficult for ownership of a business, especially an owner-operator business or a smaller family-owned type of a business, for that ownership to be able to continue to innovate and grow and really be kind of at the front of the market for years and years and years and years. It's difficult. And if you kind of hold on too long, a lot of times the business will plateau or start to, take a step back, because just, the natural creative destructive cycle, it's very, very difficult to be really great for 10, 15, 20 years at the same thing.
That absolutely makes sense. I mean, you look at the businesses that survive. I mean, I guess everyone, because the big brands make such a disproportionate impact on our brains that we think that things are around for a lot longer. Intuitively, we feel things are around for a lot longer than they actually are. And something like Coca-Cola is so the exception to the rule, right? I think like of all the companies that were in the FTSE 100 or S&P 500 or the Dow Jones 30, whatever it was, way back 100 years ago, there's probably like one left. I mean, Coca-Cola is the example that always springs to mind. It started in the 1890s, but even then that mutated very massively from its origins, which was supposed to be a medicine. It had cocaine in it. I mean, this couldn't be more different now, right?
That's so right.
It's one of those realities that we have to get our heads around. Even mega massive corporations that feel like they're around forever, they're not. They just feel like it. So it's a very good point. And we're going to dig a bit deeper into that whole question of what the alternatives are to a straight up sale. But a lot of people are interested in a straight up sale. They're not necessarily wanting to hang on to business forever. So the next question is then, basic, simple question, if you're wanting to sell something, what are the buyers of businesses looking for? And the other question, I guess, that implies is who buys businesses?
Yeah, I'll, I can start with that. I mean, specific to Amazon businesses, different buyers look for different things, right? I would say when you're looking at Amazon specifically, a private label brand is going to be much more attractive than a reseller. When you have your own brand and you've done things to really build that brand and make it strong and shine, when you've got, a diversified or a good product roadmap and obviously healthy margins, and the business is producing cash. That's also something I think very, very important to notate. There's a lot of, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, but there's a lot of myths around selling your business. But one of the most important health metrics is that it's producing cash. And that's got a lot of good protection around the business as well. So
those are the things that people are looking for. Now, let's dig a little bit more into the question of who buys businesses, because I've spoken to people before on the show about the sort of private buyers, sort of wealthy individuals, maybe they're retired CEOs, what have you, retired doctors in some cases, particularly in the States, that can get pretty wealthy, I guess. And so, yeah, so that's one type of buyer. Tell us a bit more. You guys obviously deal with quite a variety of buyers, more on the questions around what the hell is private equity, what is venture capital, what is angel investing. I don't really know the difference between those. So first of all, are those the kinds of people that buy the businesses? And if so, can you explain the differences?
Sure. So I'll hopefully not drone on too much, but I think it's good to sort of segment the market a little bit. I think it might be helpful for your listeners. So if you start with the smallest of businesses and then go all the way to the largest of businesses, then you kind of can follow that path a little bit. And the kinds of people who buy those businesses, they tend to change as the businesses become larger. So when you know, the smallest of small businesses, let's say transactions that the business is being sold for, you know, less than $2 million US, let's say. That's kind of one segment of the market. And that tends to be mostly individual buyers that quite often and most often are actually wanting to be the owner and the operator of the business themselves. So they're looking to buy a cash flowing business that will also become their job, essentially. So that's the most common in the smaller segment. When you go from $2 million to, let's say, $5 or $6 million, you start to sprinkle in some additional types where there would be groups we call buyer groups, which are just really individuals that have decided to pool their money together. Again, still fairly informal, but you start to get more into the investor groups, as well as family offices start to participate. And what I mean by a family office is a wealthy family that has generational wealth, that has a lot of money that they can invest on their own. Instead of taking those funds to an outside investment company to invest for them, they'll often establish their own office internally that works for the family and invests on their behalf. So you'll get those guys in there in that smaller kind of $2 to $5 million segment. And then as you get over $5 million and really into the $10 million plus area, that's where private equity firms tend to come in and dominate the market. And, you know, in the U.S. alone, there are over 4,000 private equity firms. And that number has grown quite substantially in the last 10 years. What a private equity firm really is, mostly, I mean, there are different structures, but it's usually a fund that has gone out and raised money from usually wealthy accredited investors. They pool the money into a formal structure. So everything is very formalized and very professional. And then those funds tend to have investment criteria, areas that they focus on. Sometimes they're specialists, sometimes they're generalists. And then they're going out, and the words private equity simply mean investing in the equity of private companies instead of publicly traded or publicly held companies. That it's really that simple from the standpoint of what does that phrase mean. And so they're going out, and private equity goes usually from $5 to $10 million, all the way up to, you know, billions of dollars for certain private equity funds that they can invest. So that size range becomes very wide for those guys. So I'll pause there, Michael. And
perfect time.
Anything else you want me to add?
Yeah, it's perfect time because I'm just making some notes here because I mean my poor show notes editors have to deal with a hell of a lot of input on different subjects. But I'm just thinking this might just be beginning to blow their minds. I better get some notes made. So just to reflect, I mean, first of all, the question: what is private equity? I mean, maybe that's a private obsession of mine, like to work out what that is. That was an extremely clear explanation. It just means they invest in privately held companies, not PLCs. But broadly speaking, it sounds, just to reflect back and make sure that I've absorbed this properly so that the listeners can as well. Small businesses, that's under $2 million, and that's $2 million value, not annual revenue, I'm presuming. That's the metric. Good, which is a distinction that we got to make sure that, because everyone obsesses about revenue as a seller, but now we've got to suddenly obsess with a different metric, which is what's the value of my business as opposed to the revenue, and we'll obviously be asking about that. But to come back, small businesses, under $2 million value, basically, it's individual buyers, and they want to be the owner and operator themselves. So that's a very distinct segment. And we've talked about that before with some people we've had on the show. And then the interesting thing now is that it starts being more about groups of people, either buyer groups that are sort of informally organized, or investor groups, or family offices. Either which way, there's either an informal or with a family office, semi-formal, and I would guess, and with private equity, formal. But either which way, it's pooling of capital of individual people, And then they're just basically looking for places to park their money that is in a private company, not in a public listed company. Is that a fair summary of my money there?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, it's, of course, I have the advantage of writing everything down while you say it. So
you did it much quicker than I did. So
that's very sweet, but you've explained it. I've had a good teacher, you know. I think it's very important to get this stuff clear in one's head, because I think one of the classic dictums, right, for anyone selling a product, number 101 on Amazon, and for anyone who's been around the block for a while, this will be hopefully meat and drink, which is, you know, first of all, you've got to understand your customer and know them and know what they want before you even start developing a product. That's kind of obvious, but I think when it comes to selling a business, I don't see why it's any different. Somebody needs to buy it and you're selling it. But there's sometimes business owners get very wrapped up in the product and their business to customer relationship, and they forget that there's a whole new packaging of stuff for the person buying their entire business. And so that's why I think you've got to understand who you're selling to. So thank you very much. That's an excellent explanation. Any other thoughts on the buyer types before we plunge into what we need to do about that?
No, because I think later on we're going to get into, you know, maybe some of the specific things that these buyer types look for, what's attractive. So we can handle that then. So I think, no, we can move on.
Great. Okay. Well, so it sounds like the next question I was going to ask was, what do you need to do as a seller to sell your business? But first, you mentioned myths, Chris. Let's deal with that first. Give us some myths about selling a business that you think comes up, and then what is the reality in your experience?
I'll mention a few. And in Jason's experience, he's probably heard a lot more. But, you know, one is, I already talked about it before, but revenue being the most important metric. It's not. Revenue is not. It's about your cash flow. You know, is your business producing real cash and cash flow, which is also something we can give color to as well, because there's also some nuances around, you know, cash flow versus profit, which I know we'll get into a little bit later, or EBITDA, et cetera, et cetera. Another one is, I need to wait until I do this and then I can sell my business. Sometimes that is true, but for the most part, if you're a business that's producing cash, it's actually not a bad thing to leave a great opportunity for a prospective buyer versus just saying, well, I need to do all of these things first. Sometimes trying to create the perfect business for a buyer actually isn't the best thing. And Jason can definitely give a lot more color to that as well.
Great. So the first question I was going to ask is, just touched on the difference between cash flow and profit. So I don't think we can just let that one slide. Let's just dig a bit more into that. What's the difference there?
Well, I think that most people, when they think of profit, they think of the net income after, you know, all expenses are paid, including a lot of times, we'll call it a tax strategy where you're trying to increase your expenses as much as possible so that you pay the least amount of taxes possible. So profit in the small business world in particular, and in the private company world in general, usually has a, you know, quite a different outcome than true cash flow. And usually that's on purpose. A lot of times, again, it's for tax purposes in particular. But primarily, you know, when an owner, especially on a small business, when an owner kind of operates it and is really getting benefits from that ownership, all of those benefits are effectively included in the cash flow of the business. So there's a couple of terms that I'll give you that are somewhat interchangeable that you may have heard before. There's seller's discretionary earnings, there's seller's discretionary cash flow, and there's owner benefit. Those are three terms that frankly mean the same thing. And for an owner-operator business, which I'm sure, you know, the vast majority of Amazon businesses are, that's the actual number that represents your cash flow. So what it really is going to be your gross profit, which I think most of your listeners probably are familiar with gross profit. And if they're not, if you don't think they are, we can get into that a little more. But it's really gross profit minus any other expenses to run the business that are not owner-related expenses, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I've got it. But can you give us a, as I say, when it comes to numbers like this, a quick example is maybe a hard thing to get. But okay, let me ask the question. Can you give us a quick example? If you've got Fred Blogs, as we call it, or Joe somebody, what do you call it? Joe somebody in...
Joe Blow.
That's the one, that's what you call him. Yeah, okay. Fred Blogs has got his business and it's worth $2 million. And yeah, give us a bit of a blow-by-blow account of how that might look.
Okay, so here's an example. Let's say Fred Blogs, he has total sales of, we'll make it easy, $100. And the cost, and he's selling products. So he has a cost of goods sold, which is what it, you know, what he pays for that product. Let's say that's $50. And let's say that includes the shipping to get that product to his warehouse or to the Amazon warehouse. So cost of goods entirely is $50. Well, that leaves him with a gross profit of $50. So let's say he takes a salary from the business that's $20. So $50 minus $20, now he has, you know, $30. Let's say that he's able to deduct $5 for his home office for tax purposes. So now he's down to $25, I guess. I said salary of what?
$20. Yeah, I'm tracking.
You want to go back on that, Michael, so I can remember my own math?
So you got this gigantic business doing $100 of revenue. I guess you could say 100,000 revenue a month or whatever it is. 50,000 a month costs for product, including shipping. 50,000 therefore gross profit, right? Then out of that, he takes his 20,000 salary. And so I suppose he has an operating profit, if that's the right term, of 30,000. I mean, I'm not expecting you guys to be accountants, but obviously there is an interaction between knowing the numbers and valuation of businesses and stuff, right? It's hence the painful questions. And then he's spending $5,000 on his home office. So yeah, I make that $25,000. At that point, what do you call that number then that we've got left over at this point?
Well, what most people would call is they would call that profit. You know, that would be the profit that most people would refer to. So my business has $25,000 of profit. So when in fact, so that's fine. That can be your profit. That's your profit for your, you know, your profit and loss statement. It's your profit for tax purposes. But the cash flow that an owner is actually kind of receiving, or the benefit that the owner is receiving, is $50,000 because of the salary being owner related, and because the fact that, you know, he's really just deducting an expense for his home office that's also owner related. So in that case, the cash flow of the business is actually $50,000, even though the profit is $25,000.
Oh, interesting. All right. And so is there much and so which metric then do we use for the valuation?
It would be cash flow. Cash flow is usually what's used for valuation.
Okay. So I'm glad I asked this question, because that's quite a profound difference. So we're going to value this business. So it's $50,000 a month, or if my maths is right, $600,000 a year in cash flow. And that's the metric that we use to base the valuation on, not the $25,000 a month so-called profit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Wow. Okay. That's a profound difference. Wow. Okay. So just going to let that sink in for a second, because that we basically doubled the value of the business. So that's right. So interesting. So EBITDA, then the earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, that famous one, yep. Which sounds again so like you really know what you're talking about, because it's got an abbreviation that nobody understands. But actually, that's a bit of a red herring then when it comes to valuing a business. Is that right?
Well, EBITDA, when it comes to an owner-operated business, it tends to not be the metric that's used. And the reason why is because you have an owner that's actually running the business themselves. So EBITDA is the more appropriate metric for a business that is a non-owner operated business. And at that point, you can really focus in on what the EBITDA is. Because if you think about it, if you owned a business as an investment, then really the free cash flow is most accurately calculated by the EBITDA. But if you actually own and operate the business, there's all these benefits that you're taking as the owner that have to be effectively added back into the profit in order to get the cash flow. So that's really the distinction between owner-operator and non-owner-operator, where in the owner-operator example that we just had, it's really more of an owner benefit, seller's discretionary earnings metric that's used. And for a non-owner-operator business, it's more of an EBITDA.
Okay, so you know what, this podcast, if anyone listening who actually has any ambition whatever to build a serious business, that little nugget I think is worth a lot, because I've never really heard anyone articulate that clearly, but you guys do this every day, so it's just got to be right. So fantastically clear. Thank you. So I'm glad to say that digging and all those numbers were worth it. People hate numbers. They're horrible on podcasts because it's nice to have figures in front of you. But hey, it was worth the sweat. So let's come back to, that was one hell of an answer that we dug into really from those things, and completely derailed my thoughts here now as well. But so we're talking about revenue and then what's the difference between cash flow and profit, which I thought was a small difference and actually is profoundly important. Thank goodness we found that. So let's go back to the question of what do you need to do as a seller then? We talked a bit about the different buyers. So I guess that implies that we've really got quite different things that we need to do. But let's say, first of all, if we split it up then according to those different things that you were talking about, Jason, with the businesses for under $2 million value. Let's start with that. First of all, I guess we ought to talk about how we value the businesses. I'm assuming that it's a multiple then of the cash flow. How does that work?
Yes, I think, you know, valuation, it's mostly science, but it's also a little bit of art. Let me kind of first say that. You know, there's not a hard and fast rule for any company to say, okay, this is exactly what the value is going to be before you actually go out and effectively market that business and you know, get the specific value. Now, that doesn't mean we can't approximate it. That doesn't mean we can't get pretty close to what, you know, a very accurate number is. But I kind of want to make that point first. So, you know, there are a lot of formulas. We even use formulas, you know, daily to provide an approximation. But it is part science and part art. And the reason why that they both come in is most companies that are operating, that have some history and are producing cash, most of them, not all, are valued on a cash flow basis. They're a multiple of the cash flow. And that goes for small businesses all the way up to much larger businesses. So if it's a private buyer, individual buyer for a small company worth $1 million, then it trades on a cash flow multiple. If it's a $50 million business, it's also going to, you know, heavily rely on multiple valuation. So one of the differences that you sort of mentioned venture capital firms and angel investors before, and I don't want to go down a total rabbit trail, but very early stage companies in, let's say, the technology world, and then in some other industries, angel investors and venture capital investors, they're investing in those companies while they're still either just an idea, or they don't have any revenue yet, or they don't have any cash flow yet. And there are reasons why those firms like to invest in companies at those stages. But valuation in those really early stages is not a multiple of cash flow. And we can do a whole, probably another podcast on that at some other time. But the difference is when you have a company that's the real operating business, that's got some history and is producing real cash, then as soon as you have that, valuation tends to really shift towards multiple of cash flow.
Makes a lot of sense. And the first thing I'd like to just reflect back is that I've heard that after all the speculation and worry about venture capital and angel investors and trying to invest in things that have absolutely no revenue, let alone profit, like the absolute extreme of that was probably the dot-com boom in the late 90s, right? But right. Have you got any take on how Amazon businesses compare with things like that for the more serious investments?
Well, because at their core, what Amazon businesses are is they're effectively just retail stores. Really, that's what they are. They're buying product, they're selling product, even though there is some business-to-business activity. So I'm kind of carving that off for the moment. The vast majority is consumer retail transactions purchasing physical products. And in that regard, they're sort of valued as such, so that, you know, we really did not see as this market for selling Amazon stores developed, it never went through a phase where venture capitalists and angel investors really got heavily involved, because from their perspective, it would be the same in a way as going down to the, you know, Main Street store and investing in a small mom and pop retail store that just opened up. And that's really not what they do. So Amazon storefronts and seller businesses, they never really had a phase where angel investors or venture capital investors were heavily involved.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, so in other words, they just go after, that's a very, again, a useful distinction. So venture capitalists, well, as the name implies, I guess they're into ventures. They're into things which are high risk, mostly going to go pop with no money, but occasionally going to blow up. Whereas this is for private equity investors, they're investing in existing businesses that have something very tangible, i.e. they're operating, they have not just revenue, but they have cash flow as well. So that's a useful distinction, actually. I suppose things like Dragon's Den or Shark Tank tend to blur the boundaries a bit, because sometimes they invest in absolutely wacky stuff, and sometimes they invest in just mom and pop little things like an ice cream store that's opening several different branches or something. So that's interesting that maybe that's blurred my perception. Too much telly, always bad for your brain, isn't it? So let's go back to the what do we need to do as a seller bit there. So we looked quite in detail, which I think is always an excellent starting point. If you're going to sell something, you understand who's going to be buying it on the other side of the equation.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, let's think about then. So if you're a seller of a business, so you own a business and you want to sell it, and it's under $2 million value. So according to what you were saying then, Jason, you're going to be looking at individual investors. What are the main things that you need to get done with your business to make it an attractive proposition to sell to those guys?
Well, I'll start on this and Chris can add, but there are some really core things that I think it's important for everyone to understand that the market really likes to see. So I'd say first and foremost, growth is a very, very big one. So showing growth, not only kind of recently, but you know, over a period of time, the longer the period of time where you're consistently showing high growth, the better. And then kind of the other big one, which a lot of business owners don't kind of fully understand, is they also want to know that when they buy the company, there's a great deal of growth to come. There's a great deal of future growth. Because if you think about it, it sounds simple, but sometimes it's good to kind of, you know, break things down simply. A buyer isn't buying your business. They don't get any benefit from your past success. They only get benefit from what happens once they buy it. So what they're looking for in a very simple way is a track record that shows this business is growing, it's growing well, and then a belief that after they buy it, it will continue to grow well. And maybe even they think they can bring in some special, you know, sauce or extra resources or some, you know, other thing that will help grow it even more. That's probably, if I had to say, what's the biggest thing that a buyer wants? They want to feel like there's a lot of growth that they can go access once they buy the business. Now, that's kind of what I'd say first and foremost. I think that, you know, as you start to go down the list, what they like to see in this market, as Chris alluded to, building of a brand is more attractive. Certainly, if that brand is protected and trademarked, and then you know that brand has got a little bit of recognition, whether it's just on Amazon or even maybe a little recognition off Amazon, brand is something that we're seeing is a very strong theme in the market, certainly recently and has been for a bit, but it's really starting to become one of the top bullet points for what buyers want. They want a strong brand. Even if it's just an Amazon brand, they want to see a strong brand. So growth, a strong brand is something that is very valuable. Something that, again, you don't take for granted, but having fairly organized financials is something that is important. So they can make sense of what the performance really is. And when during the due diligence period where they're, you know, poking and prodding, they're able to quickly verify what they've been told. Also, you know, very important. I think that we're seeing differentiation in category now as well. Categories like, let's say, pet products, which are very, very popular. Those are, you know, buyers would like to see categories that are kind of on the upswing more than categories that maybe aren't trending so well in general. I think from an Amazon kind of structural standpoint, Chris, maybe you can jump in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you are looking under the hood of a seller central account, you know, going back to that growth point that Jason made, there tends to be a trend that I've seen with some sellers where they like to brag about fast growth and quick growth. That's awesome and great. But from a buyer's perspective, you know, they want a little bit of longer history than just say, you know, 3 months of incredible hockey stick growth. Even more than 6 months. I mean, unless they've got some type of amazing IP, amazing patented product, for the most part, going back to Jason's point and adding some more color to that, they want to see longer term growth. And, you know, the brand is number one. You know, I mentioned reseller earlier, and just to harp on that for just a moment, if you've got some exclusive arrangements with brands or exclusive arrangements with certain SKUs, and you're a reseller, that's obviously more attractive. But if you're just a pure reseller, the issue there is the risk. You know, you risk all of your revenue going away just because for a myriad of reasons. You might be competing with 10 other resellers, or a brand decides that they want to just bring everything in-house. You know, you just raise your risk. And so at that point, you know, trying to sell your business to a prospective buyer, they're going to look at that as more of a suppressed, much more of a suppressed model. So
great. Wow. That's quite a lot to take on board there. So basically this is all for the sort of $2 million valuation, although I guess, and therefore for individual buyers, if I understand, although I guess that we can certainly dig, I'd imagine these will apply at all levels. So growth is important. Really glad that Jason, you picked up on the potential future growth, because in a way, again, we get a bit obsessed with what's already happening. And as you just said, and it's kind of obvious once you think about it, but we mostly don't as business owners, right? It's not about your track record. That's only a value insofar as it gives them belief. Well, the actual value to a buyer stops exactly the point. It starts at the point where it stops for us. We hand over the keys to the business, as it were. And then at that point, that future growth is what they're in business for. So that's really important. And I think it's a very important mindset to guide us in terms of creating a sellable business. Brand, obviously important. The fact that it's getting stronger is an important selling point. Makes a lot of sense to me, because that happens at this product-based level as well. You get a better price premium. It's more defensible. Organized financials, we're all pretty guilty. I mean, I certainly am. I've got some poor Indian guy right now digging through my amazing FBA financials. I've had my British accountant trying to deal with Pro Music Hit and various other things that I've run as Amazon businesses. I hear you on that one. And then differentiation in categories, again, pretty obvious, but it makes sense to go into something that's going to be a good business anyway. One interesting thing also to reflect on just before we come back to you is the fact that if something's going to be hard to sell because it's not a very defensible business, it means you probably should be transitioning out of that model as quickly as possible, right? I mean, I think, as you said right at the beginning, Jason, it's not necessarily about selling your business overnight, but whether or not you sell it, the discipline of preparing something to sell is a very important discipline. And that's like the most major hit in the world is, guys, if you're reselling stuff, please start transitioning over as soon as you can, because it's hyper risky. So let's come back to a few of the questions that come out of that for me. One of them is, okay, we keep talking about the length of stuff we got for the business, length of data, length of time it's been alive indeed. How old does a business have to be to sell at this kind of level? Is there sort of a minimum age?
Well, I would say the minimum age is going to be 6 months, but there will be let's say you have a business that has 6 months of really strong performance and it's only 6 months old. And then you have a business that is 3 years old and it has that same level of performance in the last 6 months as the 6 month old business does. The one that's 3 years old is likely to sell for a much higher price. When we talk about minimums, it's really in the context of valuation. A six-month-old Amazon business, depending on certain factors, could absolutely sell. It's just likely to sell for a lower price, for really the main reason being that, you know, just the track record isn't long enough. And therefore, the feeling is that the risk profile is worse for that business because there's not as much data to really look at and get comfortable with.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. And as my next question was going to be, does that affect the multiples? But you clearly answered that, and it's kind of obvious that it would, right? So that the other extreme then, is it possible to wait too long? If you're wanting to sell a business and you've been working on it for a number of years, is there a kind of sweet spot? Because we talked about the implication of the data says that you're not going to pass this on to your kids in most cases. The implication is at some point the business is going to start falling off and become less valuable, or in fact just not survive. As we all know, the statistics, 9 out of 10 fail in the first 3 years, 9 in 10 fail in the next, 15, blah, blah, blah. So where is that kind of sweet spot? I mean, it's kind of a how long is a piece of stone question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it seems important.
Well, I don't know that there's a specific time period that you can say is too long, but that's the time. It's kind of in relation to the performance of the business. So what I would say is if you have maximized the business, everything you can do, your abilities, your resources, and then your business starts to plateau, then the answer is you've waited too long. And at that point, and this is something, again, we've talked about it a little bit earlier, but the reason why a multiple for a business will be higher is because of the stronger growth opportunity. So if you have business A and business B, business A, they have the exact same levels of revenue and profit, but the market believes that business A has much stronger growth prospects than business B, then business A will sell for a much higher price than business B. And so while maybe you have increased your cash flow by holding on to it and growing it as far as you possibly could, but you still actually get less for the business because the feeling is there's not a lot of growth opportunity that has a big effect. So even though now you have a higher cash flow, you actually sell your business for a lower amount of money because the growth story isn't very good.
Okay, so in other words, the implication of if it started to plateau, you waited too long. So I guess hindsight's 2020 vision, but I suppose one of the implications of that is if you are now, at a certain point and you're doing, say, $500,000 a month revenue at a certain profit level with your own in-house resources and your own cash flow, if you can look ahead and you're realistic enough to go, well, you know what, if we want to scale to a million, we ain't going to be able to do that with in-house funds and expertise. I guess then you're starting to look at either selling it before it plateaus or getting out and raising capital, which brings me really to the different topic of raising capital. And there's a few related things as well. And I think we're going to split that up into a different episode because we've been going for quite a while now. So I'd love people to absorb this properly and then be able to absorb that properly as well. So we'll come and revisit that, folks. So thank you very much for all the input on that side. And we'll revisit the raising capital thing in the next episode.
Sounds great. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.